BadQuaker.com audio article for Friday, July 29th, 2011 by Ben Stone. Impossible Rules of Engagement. When I was very young, I was taught a confusing and contradictory set of rules about fighting. My father's number one rule for me was to never throw the first punch. But my father's other number one rule was to never let anyone push me around or lay a rough hand on me. And my father's other number one rule was for me to never be the one who starts a fight, but always be the one who finishes it. And above and beyond everything else, my father taught me to never be the bully, but never submit to a bully. So, in actual conflicts, I could not allow myself to be bullied, pushed around, or aggressively handled, but I wasn't allowed to strike first, and it was required of me to win every physical conflict. This is an impossible standard. Tactically speaking, it simply can't work. If I'm never to throw the first punch, what am I to do while my opponent is bullying, pushing, and manhandling me? My mother would try to help me with advice that I should use words to diffuse conflicts. The problem with that was that when I was around anyone other than family, I was slow of speech and a borderline stutterer. To make matters worse, I was considerably larger than the average boy my age, and we almost never lived in the same place more than a year or two, which meant I was always the new kid. So I was a bully magnet, attracting every little junior thug who had something to prove. Even though I was almost always the youngest in my class, public school teachers would take one look at my size and my speech, and without bothering to check the records, would assume I was a problem student who had been held back a grade or two. This usually made matters worse, since very often the class bully was also the teacher's pet, as the teachers were completely out of touch with what was actually going on in their classrooms and on the playground. So, no matter who started a conflict, I was always singled out to carry the blame. At times, I wasn't even involved in the fight, and yet somehow the teacher would snatch me out of the crowd and I would be the one in the principal's office. I learned it was better to sit quiet and accept the punishment than to try to explain the situation and get punished anyway. At home, I was constantly roughhousing with my brother, who was 12 years my senior. We watched the fake wrestling on TV and practiced the moves almost daily. When I was 5 years old, my brother started a rigorous exercise routine to prepare himself for entry into the U.S. Marines. So I was right there by his side doing hundreds of push-ups and thousands of sit-ups. By the age of 6, I was probably the only second grader in the San Jose public school system with washboard abs who could do one-handed pull-ups and double-clap push-ups. We humans are amazingly adaptable creatures. Given the impossible task of dealing with stupid teachers, aggressive bullies, and impossible rules of engagement, I developed a sort of informal martial art. Utilizing wrestling moves along with my superior physical condition and size, as soon as a bully started his routine, I would either sweep his feet or grapple him to the ground, quickly throwing him into a chokehold. Then I would await the inevitable authority figure to break things up and punish me. This solution fulfilled all the requirements my father had placed upon me, as I didn't strike my opponent, and it served to humiliate the bully. Sure, I always got punished when a teacher or some other tax eater arrived, but I was being punished either way, so that didn't matter. That policy served me well through most of my school years, but with time, I could see some adjustments were needed. For example, I was with some friends at a baseball game, cheering for my cousin and his team, when fans of the opposing team decided to teach us that their town was far better than our town. They began throwing rocks at us. Being the largest male in our group, it was my task to challenge the rock thrower. But as I marched up to him, and before I could grab him or sweep his feet, he punched me in the nose 3 times. Choking, spitting blood, and momentarily unable to see, I was filled with rage and lunged at my opponent. He wisely ran, jumped on a bicycle, and took off across the parking lot. So the lesson learned was that a fist has both a speed and a reach advantage to a grappling move, and an upper body strike can happen faster than a leg sweep. So I decided to never again allow anyone the opportunity to strike me first. That was the last time a fist touched my head. I adopted the same opinion of my father's rules that I had of the school's rules, and once I developed my hand speed, I settled on a new tactic. As soon as my opponent was within range, I would feign a punch by slightly jerking my left hand, causing him to raise his hands defensively. Anyone not seeing my left hand move would assume he was taking a fighting stance. At that point, I would deliver a quick right hook followed with a flurry of punches, finishing the fight and usually rendering my opponent either unconscious or bleeding so badly he had no heart to continue. In addition, I learned to hurt my opponent as quickly and as severely as possible so that he would never again want to face me. As a young adult, this new policy worked well when the police would show up, since witnesses would generally agree that I was simply defending myself. This is the part of the article where I'm supposed to tie this all together with something relevant that my reader can apply to their life today. Otherwise, it just gets classified as the ramblings of an old fat man remembering his glory days. I hope I can pull this off, as I actually have 2 points that I'd like to make. Let's start by looking at my father and his rules of engagement. You see, my father had several strengths and only a few weaknesses. As a child, he taught himself to read at the age of 4 by looking at newspaper comics. By the age of 12, he decided school had nothing more to offer, so he stopped going. That same year, his family bought their first automobile, a Ford Model T truck. He wanted to see what made it work, so he disassembled and reassembled the engine in one day. At the age of 14, he left home to see what adventures life had available for him. He began moving from place to place and job to job. As an adult, he was a brilliant inventor, engineer, mechanic, and a tinkerer. In his mind's eye, he could look inside a machine and imagine all its parts as they performed their symphony, and with almost magical ability, he could fix or improve almost anything that man had created. Given a task that no machine had been built to do, my dad would retreat to his shop and conjure a device perfect for the job. However, life was not easy for my father. As a boy, my dad suffered a horrible accident. At the age of 9, he lost most of his left hand and his fingers, leaving him a stub almost resembling a pig's foot. So credit his superior intellect, his silver tongue, or pity for his disfigurement, throughout his life, he never actually fought an actual fistfight. You can see that his rules of engagement were strictly theoretical and terribly flawed. I would compare my father's judgment on personal combat to those rules of engagement laid upon members of the U.S. military by both the clueless civilian population and the chicken hawks that hold the reins of power in Washington, D.C. American warriors are given an absolutely impossible task and are expected to accomplish that task by engaging in behavior detrimental to their success. All the while, the State Department seems to do everything it can possibly do to get the U.S. military involved in as many countries as possible by constantly provoking more aggression. Wise economists of the Austrian school of thought say all this warmongering is happening because the idiots in Washington believe the old superstition that war is good for the economy. So they use the fear and the ignorance of the public to whip the nation into a froth over this threat or that, whatever or whoever the devil of the day needs to be to feed the flames of war. I have no doubt the economists are right as far as their theory goes, but I see a more sinister evil driving the state than merely stupidity. Without getting into yet another attack on the state, and its need for constant war, let me say something far simpler that I believe to be true. Free people need warriors, but war itself should be the last resort and not entered into unless you're willing to unleash your warriors to do their art unhampered by the rules of polite society. War should never be a tool of government to accomplish some end result. War should be brutal and brief, eliminating the threat with extreme measures. The old saying, "Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war," holds within it a principle. If there is an actual threat, have at it with every ounce of your being and crush that threat. But when you use superior strength and technology to intimidate other nations into behaving the way you want them to behave, you're simply being a bully and you should be crushed. My second point is a bit different. It has to do with the left-handed flinch that I mentioned and how I used it to draw a reaction from my opponent, therefore justifying the follow-through right hook. I did this move as a form of protection from authority. I could justify sending my opponent to the hospital by witnesses agreeing that I was not the aggressor. I could have followed my father's rules and allowed him to hit me first, but after experiencing that once, I decided I didn't like the result. But the state has no such pain mechanism to teach it new behavior. So it continues sticking its nose out, asking for someone to punch it. And when it has stuck its nose into enough places, someone always punches it. Except when this happens, it's not the state that bleeds, because the state has no blood of its own. When the state provokes action, people bleed. People, like the ones on board the RMS Lusitania on May 17, 1915, or the ones who happened to be in the wrong place on December 7, 1941, or September 11, 2001. But again, the state has no pain mechanism, so it has no reason to change its behavior. So Washington, D.C., continues to provoke war while binding its warriors, never learning and always expanding, answering to no one as it has its way with weaker nations. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.